North Korea continues to issue threats of attacks against South Korea and the United States. What's going on and how worried should we be? Good morning, I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. Here's some of the latest. North Korea has apparently been preparing for a test missile launch, maybe another nuclear weapons test. They've just warned foreigners in South Korea that they're in danger of war, possibly thermonuclear war. And in the last couple days, the nation has suspended a joint economic project with South Korea. This hour, I'll talk with Su-Mi Terry. She is senior research scholar in the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University. In the past, she has monitored North Korea and the region for places including the CIA, the National Security Council, and the National Intelligence Council. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The headline of a recent story on Wired.com caught our attention. Here's the headline. Ex-CIA analyst expects North Korea to attack South Korea before tensions end. Well, you are that ex-CIA analyst. It sounds kind of scary. What could this attack look like?
Well, that comment was taken a little bit out of context. I didn't mean North Korea is going to attack South Korea in a nuclear attack or United States. What I meant by that was that it would come in the form of limited, calculated, and controlled attack. And they will come after this missile launch and after a nuclear test, after Washington not respond to any of these provocative measures. And so I can elaborate a little bit on that. Mm-hmm. In 2010, in March 2010, Korea attacked South Korea. I don't know if you remember, but North Koreans sank South Korean corvette ship in March 2010. And that took a couple months for us to find out and figure out that it was indeed North Korea and it was indeed a torpedo attack. And by the time that we figured it out, it was too late for, well, not, it wasn't too late, but it had cooling off period and we were not able to really respond. So what I meant by North Korea attacking South Korea is that it will do so, but it will do so in a creative way that it's hard to retaliate against. These people are very smart. They're not all that crazy. I know they look and sound crazy, but they're not all that crazy, and they have a very smart policy in place.
And we've seen similar stories, as you mentioned, in that 2010 attack and before, kind of pushing up to the brink, a small attack, but nothing that leads quite to the brink of all-out war. But how much is there a risk of a miscalculation when you're playing that kind of very delicate game?
Of course, there's always room for miscalculation that could lead to a crisis that no one intends. I mean, and certainly Kim Jong-un does not want a general war because he knows that if a war breaks out, if an all-out war breaks out, it will mean the end of the North Korean regime as he knows it, as end of North Korea. But as you just mentioned, unfortunately, history has taught the Kim three now, and his father and his grandfather, that it pays for North Korea to provoke and do this. It's really hard to understand North Koreans in from a normal person's perspective because we try to understand North Korea from our rational prism. But if you see it from their perspective, they've done this for decades now. And if you look at, and we have not responded, not ever in terms of, you know, truly responding to any of their provocations. South Korea always exercised restraint, for example. And the list is long. And that in itself would be a half an hour. But, you know, North Korean commando raid attack on Blue House from 1968 to multiple assassination attempts on the South Korean presidents, including, by the way, killing First Lady of South Korea, who is the current mother of the current president in South Korea in 1974. In 1983, bombing of in Yangon in Myanmar that took place in Burma at the time, which killed half of the South Korean cabinet. They blew up Korean airliner in 1987, killing all 115 people on board. And, you know, but there was no response because we are always afraid of North Korea, you know, escalating out of control. And U.S. too, we have a long history of making concessions to North Korea in response to its provocative behavior.
And is that a mistake to make concessions? I mean, have we in effect been training North Korea to make these aggressive moves and then rewarding them with whatever they're looking for at the time, negotiations, food? We can get into that a little more later. But is it partly Is it partly our fault that they keep doing this because they know it works and we're not going to respond?
Well, yes, I do think so. I mean, it's hard to fault us, but it is true that, and we have been doing that, and we've done it under the Democratic administration, we've done it under the Republican administration. You know, we did have one time this agreed framework that everybody points to. In 1994, President Clinton did conclude the agreed framework, which promised to help North Korea build nuclear plants if they shut down the nuclear weapons program. But what did they do? I mean, I was at the CIA at the time when we found out that they were actually pursuing uranium enrichment program in 2001, in 2002. We have a long history of trying to reach agreement, but it only has bought us temporary peace. In 1998, again under Clinton, we had this they launched a missile launch in 1998, and then we had this flurry of diplomatic activities, which resulted in Washington sort of pledging to send us some 400,000 tons of food, which was worth like $200 million. And then we went into North Korea, and then we inspected an empty cave. So it's not only the Clinton administration, even George W. Bush, after the so-called hardline first term, after following the October 2006 first nuclear test, second term Bush administration, we tried to negotiate again, you know, in response to the nuclear test. And in the last year of the Bush administration, when I was at the National Security Council, we even took North Korea off the terrorism list, trying to negotiate with them. And so my point is, yes, we have a long history of doing this, and it's just not working. So from North Korean perspective, they're trying to throw everything at us because they know eventually we will cave and get back to talks, and that's what they're aiming for.
That's Sue Mae Terry. She's a researcher at Columbia University, used to be with the CIA and the National Security Council. We're talking about North Korea. Latest, and over the last few weeks, the latest round of threats of war, of nuclear weapons testing, warnings to get out of South Korea, foreigners, something bad's going to happen. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Are you worried about what's going on in North Korea? Do you think they're a real threat to world security? Or is this just more of the same sort of thing we've seen over the past bunch of years? And what do you think, if anything, the United States should do about it? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Professor Terry, what you mentioned that there's rationality. This isn't just crazy action going on. What does the leader of North Korea hope to get out of this latest round of provocations?
Well, there are a couple of things. First, they're testing us, obviously, but they want us to get back to talks so that we can, you know, they want to lure Washington back into talks to ease sanctions that are in place and secure concessionary aid worth billions of dollars, as his father, Kim Jong-il, did repeatedly in the past. Secondly, North Korea wants to be accepted by the international community and by us as a nuclear power. When they get back to talks, the problem is they are saying, we do not want to talk about denuclearization. You should already accept us as a nuclear power like Pakistan and deal us as that. Of course, there's also internal domestic reasons. Domestic factor is always at play. He's only been in power for a year and 3 months. And of course, you know, when you have this over exaggerated, blown up external threat that they can hype up, it helps to consolidate internal support. And you know, he has a lot to gain by looking tough against Washington, you know, to get that support from the elites and the military.
And you mentioned sanctions. Some of those were imposed after the latest nuclear test back in February, I think it was.
Yes.
What are those sanctions? What's their impact on North Korea?
Well, you know, sanctions is a good question. It doesn't have an impact if we are trying to destabilize the regime. It does not have an impact if we are trying to change North Korea's nuclear policy. But it does have a big psychological impact. We are making it hard for them to do business. We are also have sort of luxury ban on luxury goods, and that does matter because one way the North Korean regime stays in power is through the elite support. It's by getting the elites to support the regime. They don't really care about the public. In mid-1990s, when there was a massive famine and millions of North Koreans died, they still survived because they were able to hold on together with the elite support. So they need these luxury goods and so on. So it does hurt the regime in that way, and it has a psychological burden. And we are also trying to crack down on the on proliferation. So if any kind of weapons, weapons bans, if any kind of North Korean weapons are leaving North Korea on a ship, we have the right to inspect them and so on. So we're trying to curtail their business and make it difficult for them. But unfortunately, we do not have, it's not changing their policy. It's not having that kind of impact that we're looking for.
That's Soo Mi Terry. She's senior research scholar in the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University, an expert on North Korea and the region. We're talking about the latest news from North Korea, Kim Jong-un issuing threats against South Korea, against the United States, for that matter. You can call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. With your calls in just a few moments, I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. Looking at today's weather, cloudy and cool, areas of fog and periods of light rain, including outside the window at scenic Vilas Hall. There's a chance of sleet and thunderstorms, highs in the 40s. Tonight, cloudy with areas of fog, a chance of rain, sleet, snow, and thunderstorms, lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 30s, still various forms of moisture, rain, snow, sleet, and thunderstorms around the state. Tomorrow, or this afternoon actually, at 1 o'clock, it's the State of the Tribe address before the state legislature. Lakota Ray Chairman Gordon Thayer presents the address, and you can hear it live at WPR.org. That's 1 o'clock today. Right now, we're talking about North Korea with Soo Mi Terry. She's senior research scholar in the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University. She has studied North Korea and the region for the CIA, the National Security Council, among other places. We'll get to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Beaver Dam. Hi, Mike.
Who are the other interested parties in this operation, and are they contributing militarily, or is it just the United States as usual?
Militarily, it's only South Korea and the United States. We just held joint exercises between South Korea and United States, and U.S. sent over nuclear-capable B-2s and B-52s over the Korean Peninsula to show deterrence and so on. But there are no other players that are involved in terms of military.
But maybe not a military role. China has a lot to say here. Where are they in all this?
China's policy is quite interesting. First of all, China always has sided with North Korea, and it was very difficult to get China to get on board. But when you just look at recent behavior, I mean, President Xi Jinping just came out 2 days ago with veiled criticism of North Korea, even though he did not name North Korea by name, but he did. There was a veiled criticism finally coming out of China. So I think China is getting quite frustrated with North Koreans. It's a different days than during the Korean War, when there was an actual alliance, a real relationship, and loyalty between the two countries. I think right now China is quite irritated. So I would say China's policy towards North Korea, I think everyone in Washington is using this term evolving, and I think that is true. It is evolving. I would not say that China's policy towards North Korea has really shifted yet. We have to wait and see. But it is changing. I think finally North Koreans are getting to them, and their Chinese are finally being able to see that their interests are being threatened by this reckless behavior by the North Koreans.
I've seen some arguments that a collapse of the North Korean regime would be a worst-case scenario for China, in part because of a potential mass influx of refugees. Is that something you think is weighing on the minds of the Chinese leadership?
That has been the key reason why we were not able to truly coordinate policy together, because our fundamental priority and interests differ in that. Washington's fundamental interest in terms of what's going on in North Korea is obviously denuclearization, North Korea not having nukes. Meanwhile, China's fundamental policy has always been preventing instability in North Korea, because if there's instability, it might lead to collapse, and then what would happen, as you just mentioned, tens of thousands of refugees leaving North Korea. Obviously, there's one place they can go, it's really through China, causing instability in the border. And China is also not looking forward to unified Korea that's South Korean-led, an American-friendly unified Korea on its border. They want this buffer zone. So for this reason, until now, we had really hard time trying to convince the Chinese to really crack down on the North Koreans.
Before we get back to the phones, let's look at one more of the neighbors in the region, Japan. Obviously worried about North Korean missiles. North Korea has launched at least one missile over Japan into the Pacific Ocean. I know there are some anti-missile missiles being deployed today, I believe. What's Japan thinking about in this, and do they have any influence over the situation?
Well, I'm not sure if they have any influence. Obviously, Japan is very concerned. Japan is going to be 100% behind America. And right now, we have a new prime minister in Japan, Prime Minister Abe, Shinzo Abe. And he is known to be a bit of a hardliner. So I'm quite positive that he's very much in support of what the Obama administration is currently doing, which is finally showing some deterrence and some muscle. So I think Japan is 100% on board with us. And, of course, you know, they remain very concerned about the situation.
Rob Ferret talking to Sue Mi Terry. She's a North Korea expert at Columbia University. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, in part about what the role of the United States should be in the North Korean situation. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We have David in Milwaukee on the line. Hi, David.
Hello, good morning.
What did you want to bring up?
Hey, so I just had a question for your guest. I just wondered what would be the perspective of the common North Korean, so to speak, because, you know, all you see on the internet and all you hear about are images of, you know, military personnel, and, you know, it just kind of, you know, begs the question, what do the common people think about this whole thing? Because, I mean, obviously, the majority of people are not in the Army. That's my question. I'll take it off there.
Hello?
Yep, Professor Terry, what do the people of North Korea think? Can we even tell?
We won't even be able to tell. But, you know, North Koreans are the most indoctrinated people on the planet. North Korea the North Korean regime is able to control the public population by having complete monopoly on information. The public has no idea what's going on. So I'm sure when you have this kind of external threat and they have been indoctrinated against thinking that the U.S. is this evil country, and so is Japan, and so is South Korea, this, you know, for 60 years, they have no other reason to think anything else. When you have this kind of external threat, because what North Korean propaganda is saying is that America is threatening them. America, you know, look how scary America is acting. So the public, I'm sure, is rallying around the elite, their leader, because they don't know better. And unfortunately, that is the situation in North Korea.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, this is a populace that has witnessed the famine you talked about earlier, killing millions of people in part due to mismanagement and malice on the part of their own government. How does that work? Do they blame South Korea, the United States for the famine and other tragedies there?
Right. I mean, it's very hard to believe, but you have to imagine that there is no internet access in North Korea. There is no cell phone use. I mean, there's some now in the border and in the elites, but the public does not have cell phone use. The public does not have internet use. There's only one television station that's propaganda, state-controlled. There's one radio station that's, you know, state-controlled. They have no access to outside information. So imagine if you were living in a country for 60 years or for your entire life since you were born, and you were taught to think one thing. Of course, it's hard to imagine for us, but that is a reality. So the regime blames the U.S. and external factors for almost everything. That's why they also need to do all this blustering, because they need us as an enemy to continue on. That's why I don't think, you know, that's unfortunately the situation. And this is how it's been going on for decades now.
And you mentioned earlier that the saber rattling, the bluster, is in part geared at domestic consumption, and you mentioned the populace. How much is appealing to the people in general important versus appealing to the military leaders, the elites you mentioned earlier?
It's always the elites, because the public does not have any kind of capability to do anything about it. Unfortunately, they cannot mobilize. They can't get together. Their security apparatus is very pervasive. So the public does not have even a mean to organize themselves into any kind of resistance. So the North Koreans, what the regime is always worried about is the elites. If there's any kind of instability that's going to come, it'll come through a coup. It'll come through a factional struggle. It'll come through from the elites and the military. And that's why it's extremely important for the Kim Jong-un to make sure that he has that elite and military support and less about the public support. Public is manipulated and controlled through propaganda and indoctrination.
Back in the Cold War, there was an art or a science called Kremlinology, trying to read the tea leaves and figure out what was going on in the Politburo of the Soviet Union. Often got it very wrong. Is there a similar thing? Is there a Pyongyangology, trying to figure out what General X is thinking or Minister X is thinking? And do we have any clue?
You know, that is very hard. North Korea is a very hard place to figure out. You're absolutely right. And I can say confidently, because I've looked at North Korea for over a decade, even at the Central Intelligence Agency. And we call North Korea a hard target, and for a good reason. It's a place that's extremely close, extremely isolated. It's hard to operate against. And so it's hard for us to try to figure out what's going on in there. And one of the most difficult things to figure out is regime intentions, what X person is thinking, what even Kim Jong-un is thinking and going to do, what Kim Jong-un, his father, was thinking. I mean, how does anybody know that? It's a very difficult place to figure out. So, yes, we are trying to read tea leaves, but we don't have much option. You know, we can just give up saying we don't understand North Korea. So, you know, you still have to look at history, you have to look at the ideology, you have to look at the culture, and, you know, try to piece together a puzzle.
That's Sue Mee Terry. She's a senior research scholar in the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University. She just mentioned she has worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, worked with the National Security Council, tracking North Korea and the region. That's what we're talking about, the latest threats from North Korea. You could join in, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're going to get a little more into the North Korean economy and what the United States is doing in all this. Stick around. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation now about North Korea and the latest rounds of threats from Kim Jong-un and his regime, threatening to attack South Korea in various ways with missiles, a likely nuclear test coming up. The latest news warning foreigners, tourists, diplomats who are in South Korea to make evacuation plans. Something bad's going to happen. There's going to be war, maybe thermonuclear war. Our guest is Sue Mee Terry. She has studied North Korea for a bunch of places, currently with Columbia University. She's been with the CIA, the National Security Council, and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your thoughts on what's going on in North Korea. Before we get back to the phones, Professor Terry, I wanted to ask, I just don't get the North Korean economy. They obviously put a lot of money into the military, a lot of money into, as you, in effect, buying off the support of generals and other elites there. But I don't see an economy there to support that. Where is the money coming from to do all this?
Well, all the nefarious activities at this point, and, you know, one of the big concern related to that is obviously North Korea's proliferation activities, because I like to call North Korea a serial proliferator, because that's how they make money. And that's one of the big concerns for us, obviously, because they've in the past have exported its ballistic and nuclear technology to countries like Iran, Syria, and Myanmar. And this is how they make money, because they don't have a legitimate economy. I mean, you remember when North Koreans built that nuclear reactor in Syria that Israel bombed. So they sell just about anything to anyone for money, and that is why we are very concerned about this nuclear program. And particularly right now, there seems to be some sort of cooperation between North Korea and Iran. We know that they have worked together. There have been shipments of ballistic missiles and components from North Korea to Iran. And we know that there's evidence that they work together in missile design. So we see a cooperation there and so on. But yes, this it's not only this. Also, it's like a counterfeiting, drug, I mean, name it, any kind of nefarious activity North Koreans are involved in it, and that's how they make money.
And I've read that you mentioned counterfeiting. North Korea operates a worldwide ring to counterfeit U.S. $100 bills. Is that right?
Yes, Supernotes. They are one of the, the biggest counterfeiters in the world, in addition to being, the proliferator of missiles and of weapons. Yes. So it's obviously this is the kind of regime that we're dealing with.
We'll get back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Dale in Chicago with us. Hi, Dale.
Yes, hi. Good morning. It's a hot topic, unfortunately. Seems to me that given the history of North Korea, losing 5 million-some men in the Korean War, that never being settled because of obstinance from the part of the U.S. planning elite, never resolved in a peaceful treaty, that what the U.S. calls, or what your guest calls as deterrence, is really seen as provocation. And if people who work for the CIA, who have a rather dismal track record in figuring out what the United States' proposed enemies are doing, namely, look what happened in Russia, if they can't see that what we call war games are seen as demonstrations of potential threats by a relatively small, austere country, I don't agree with their economic policies, but it's their country. They suffered under the Japanese. They suffered under the attack by the United States, which was masked under the guise of a UN action, that they're standing up as they have a right to. Unfortunately, the U.S. seems to be bent on demonstrating that we have the biggest power, the biggest military, and that what we say goes. And I think it would be good if the United States actually talked instead of threatened with the countries that are deemed enemies.
Thanks for the call, Dale. So let's track that back to the Korean War. He makes the case that the U.S. was the aggressor, he said, under the guise of a U.N. resolution.
Well, I think the Korean War, the origin of the Korean War has been settled by now by many, many historians. On June 25th, it is Kim Il-sung who attacked South Korea. And it was Kim Il-sung with, who got a permission from Mao, China, and Soviet Union at that time, and attacked South Korea, not the other way around. And we are the one, U.S., with a tremendous international support, U.N., almost every country, 26 countries or so on, participated in that, and we went and in defense of South Korea. And so, you can look that up as a part of history. In terms of talking to North Koreans, we've done that. I don't understand when we've actually shown any kind of deterrence until even just recently. I think beginning of the hour, I gave you this whole long list of times that we actually talked to them, even came to an agreement with them. The problem is they continually cheated. Even after 1994 agreed framework, we found out that they were pursuing uranium enrichment program. So, it's not, I don't buy that argument the U.S. is to blame for North Korea's behavior. North Korea is one of the worst countries in the world. Right now, they have 200,000 to 250,000 people in political prison camps that are separate from criminal prison camps. For doing what? For criticizing Kim Jong-il, for writing, for not having their, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il poster on the wall correctly. Their prison camps, one of the camps is even larger than, there are 12, 13 operating camps. One camp is even larger than three times the size of Washington, D.C. I mean, these are, people that we're dealing with. So I can't disagree more with the caller, but everybody is entitled to having their own opinion.
Well, even if you don't buy the Dale's premise that North Korea is the aggrieved party here, does it give us insight into the mindset of the leadership of North Korea to think, they're thinking back on the Japanese invasion, they're thinking back on what they lost in the Korean War, and from their perspective, everything they're doing, nuclear proliferation, saber-rattling, is, in their minds, a very legitimate defense.
Of course. course. That's why I said, you know, part of the reason we have a hard time figuring everything out is because we refuse to see it from their perspective and their lenses. And it absolutely makes sense from North Korean's perspective. The Korean Peninsula was under a 36 year of Japanese rule. And when the Koreans were finally liberated in August 1945 with the defeat of Japan, what happened? It was the U.S. and Soviet Union and that came in and divided the country in 1945. It used to be a one country for thousands of years, and now you have a divided country. And so it all makes sense from the North Korean perspective of what they're doing.
We'll get back to the phones now. We have Adam with us in Appleton. Hi, Adam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. A statement, a question, and then a follow-up question to my statement. I guess earlier you had a question regarding how North Korea makes money. They also grow opium. I think about two-fifths of the country grow poppies. But I also had a question for your guests regarding the benefit to China regarding this situation. Can't China basically play two sides of the fence or two sides of the coin here where they get to test us but, you know, unofficially help North Korea? And if North Korea should invade South Korea, what's the possibility of China giving them food to sustain their war effort? Thank you for taking my call.
Wow, a lot there. First, briefly, Adam's comments. Is North Korea a big grower of poppies for opium?
Well, I wasn't quite aware of opium being a big problem in North Korea, but it could be. So I will have to look into that. I didn't somehow, with all these concerns about North Korea, opium wasn't something that I was considering, but I'll definitely look into that. In terms of China, whether China will help North Korea, that has been the way we thought until very recently, and that could very well be. I mean, we mentioned earlier, we discussed China's interest in the Korean Peninsula is really stability, and they would like to avoid instability. So if any kind of war was really breaking out, or if we were seeing any kind of collapse or the regime unraveling, we assumed that China would try to do what it can to help North Korea. What we are trying to do, what we as in Washington and Seoul, is make China see that it's not necessarily in their interest to do so. We're trying to make China shift its thinking into thinking that current situation is not viable, and the unified Korea, even under South Korean-led unification, is not necessarily a bad thing for China. I mean, China and South Korea also have a separate relationship right now. China is one of South Korea's largest trading partner. So hopefully it will shift, but as of now, if a war broke out right now, I think China would still side with North Korea, yes.
That's Sue Mee Terry. She researches North Korea at Columbia University. She's been with the National Security Council and the CIA, researching that same region as well. We're talking about the latest ongoing news from North Korea, the threats lately warning foreigners in South Korea to get ready to leave because of the risk of war. You could join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's weather, highs in the 40s, areas of fog, periods of light rain, and a chance of sleet and thunderstorms in parts of the state. I heard a little thunder earlier. Tonight, cloudy with areas of fog. Still a chance of rain, sleet, snow, and thunderstorms with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 30s, lows in the 20s. Still some rain, snow, and sleet around the state. Coming up after 8, it's On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley joins us. He's got answers to your personal finance questions, a lot of information about houses and mortgages as well. This hour, we're still talking about North Korea, the latest threats, risk of war, small attacks maybe. Our guest is Sue Mee Terry. She's with Columbia University. She's been studying North Korea for a good long time. She's worried about a small attack, not a full-scale war, but some kind of small, maybe subtle thing that might be hard to respond to. Get back to your calls in just a few moments at 800-642-1234. Before we do, Professor Terry, let's talk a little bit about the United States recently in this. You've alluded to this a couple times, and I let it hang here till toward the end of the show. You said you're seeing signs of a tougher response, maybe not being so quick to give in.
Yes. I mean, what I mean by tough is the not returning to the talks. That in itself was very hard for us to do it. We have not done that. We have repeatedly returned to talks every time there was a provocation. That's just that started long time. This is decades of returning to talks because, look, they sound very scary, and we don't want to escalate tensions. But what we've finally learned is just returning to talks in itself only buys temporary peace and not a real peace. And now, on top of it all, North Korea is saying that they don't want to return to talks to talk about denuclearization. So what is the point? So the Obama administration really has not responded, and I'm sure it comes to as a surprise to North Korea. Remember when the Obama administration first came in, he said he had an outstretched hand to the North Koreans, saying that, you know, I would even meet with Kim Jong-il anytime, any place. And within the first 6 months of Obama coming to the office, North Korea greeted him with missile launches, nuclear tests, and withdrawing from six-party talks, pursuing uranium enrichment program. And then Obama basically said, okay, that's it. We're going to exercise this policy called strategic patience and not reward bad behavior. And I'm sure this firm and resolute stance is unnerving for North Koreans. And that's why, and that's one reason why they're escalating and they're trying to throw everything at us to force Obama's hand and to return to talks.
And part of the reason we keep returning to talks, we, the United States, over the many years, is we want to avoid the worst case scenario. I mean, how awful would an all-out war be between North and South Korea and by extension the United States?
If there's an all-out war, there's no question that North Korea will be defeated in a matter of days. South Korea's military is capable of doing that, even without United States' help. So it will just mean the end of North Korea. However, the Korean Peninsula, I don't know if you've been to Korea, but it's a very small country. There's no question that Seoul can be devastated with artillery strikes coming out of Pyongyang. And we cannot take everything out right away, so there will be some devastation and destruction in Korea. I can tell you how many people, there will be casualties, but there will be serious devastation, and that's what everyone is trying to avoid.
We'll get back to the phones now. We have Bernie in Elkhorn with us. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. Prior to Bush II, the two Koreas were talking about reuniting, but Bush was an obstructionist in letting that happen. The gentleman from Chicago was right on. During World War II, more ordnance was dropped on North Korea than we dropped during the Korean War, we dropped more ordnance than we dropped in all of World War II. North Korea was leveled. They have every reason to be afraid. The war games I heard on Democracy Now! That we recently had were very threatening to North Korea. In our press, all we hear is government propaganda, and this is more of the same. We spend more on the military than almost the rest of the world combined. We sell way more armaments than North Korea does. All our wars are based on lies. Remember Iraq II? That was weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. Iraq I, that was babies thrown out of incubators that didn't happen. Vietnam, Gulf of Tonkin, didn't happen. When are the American people going to wise up? But the military-industrial complex needs people in this country to be afraid. And our representative may believe, our talker may believe everything she's saying, but she is part of that military-industrial complex, and I am sick of hearing these lies. And she probably believes them, but these are lies. We need to mind their own business. Leave that disturbed little country alone that suffered enough at our hands.
Thanks for the call, Bernie. Let's start with that first point he brought up. North Korea and South Korea were working toward reunification. He says the second President Bush stymied that?
No, not at all. What did Bush 2 do? I don't quite understand. What he means is by maybe Clinton was thinking about going to North Korea and having a visit after Secretary of State Albright went and had a visit. But when Bush's George W. Bush came in, it's true that he did exercise what people call the hardline policy. There was a review of North Korea policy, so their momentum was lost. And it's true that in 2002 State of Union Address, President Bush, remember that the famous Axis of Evil speech, which did sour relations between Washington and North Korea. So there was some momentum in the last months of the Clinton administration, which got completely lost with George W. Bush's first years in the office. But in the second term, George Bush did reverse its policy and did engage with North Korea in the aftermath of the first nuclear test in October 2006.
And Bernie's main point, we're getting misinformation about North Korea. Yeah, it's not a good place, but it's not a threat. We should leave it alone, he says.
Well, we did leave it alone. I mean, what are we doing? Right now, North Koreans are the one who's threatening the United States with nuclear attack, right? Are we threatening North Korea with a nuclear attack? We're not there. We're not, you know, they're the one who's on making news every single day, and this is exactly why I'm on your show. It's not because we did anything. They are saying, you know, they are the one who's threatening with CL fire for South Korea and nuclear attack to the United States, showing videos and every single day trying to make news. What are we doing exactly right now? So we are just showing, having a military exercises. We even canceled recent the missile launch test just to not escalate tensions further. So really, the ball is in North Korea's hand. Listen, I mean, there are going to be two schools of thought in this. If you want to blame the United States, and if this is such a terrible country, the guests can go and live in North Korea and see how he likes to live there.
Thanks for the call, Bernie. We've got Kyle in Sussex with us now. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. I'm a fourth-generation military, and I have a friend who was in SAR, Search and Air Rescue, and he and his group were in North Korea rescuing somebody who'd been shot down, and they got shot down, and they got caught. They were taken up to Pyongyang, and when they got there, there was a gentleman in uniform directing traffic, but there were no cars. And when they started making comments of it and found it quite comical, the people guarding them started beating them because it was more important to say, yes, there are cars there, than to admit that there are no cars because their leader deemed he should direct traffic. My question then is, when or if we win, this regime collapses, what is the plan to help these people to reintegrate to society? Because they're literally in a feudal system. It's not going to take a pamphlet or just a discussion to correct a group of people who think their leader can see them. And so on. I mean, it's sad. But even if we win, there's going to be a commitment to help these people afterwards. What is the plan for that? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
You're absolutely correct that this is a serious problem. Even if there's instability and collapse, there will be so many challenges, and one of the challenges is reintegrating the North Koreans with South Koreans. Right now, we have a small way of seeing how that would look like, what that would look like, because we have North Korean defectors, many defectors living in South Korea, and they're having a very difficult time because obviously they have not went through a normal education system in a sense that, you know, what they've been learned and taught is Kim Il-sungism in a way, and completely indoctrinated. And this is going to be a serious challenge for the international community. Unfortunately, I'm not sure if we have a comprehensive planning in place. I know we have joint military planning in place, but that's very different from reconstruction, very different from trying to, you know, help the North Korean people. South Korea has a Ministry of Unification, and I'm sure those folks are, you know, thinking about how to incorporate North Koreans. But there's no denying it's a very sad situation. And one thing we didn't get to mention during this hour is a serious humanitarian disaster that's going on in North Korea. I mentioned briefly about the political prisoners, but the defectors and the just human rights issues that's going on in North Korea. It's a very sad situation.
And you mentioned the Ministry of Unification in South Korea 60 years after the active Korean War. Do you get a sense that among South Korean leaders and the populace, there's still a hope that Korea is going to be united again, maybe in their lifetimes?
Yes, although that thinking is changing. My grandparents, paternal grandparents, came from North Korea. So half of my family came from North Korea. And that generation, unfortunately, they both passed away now, was just always longing for unification. And they just can't think of anything more important than unifying these two countries with same people, same language, same culture, same history for thousands of years. The problem is, as this older generation is dying off, the younger generation is less concerned about unification, obviously, in South Korea. It's a very different country, South and North. They're very advanced, economically developed, and younger people, like in most developed countries, are more worried about, you know, the latest fads and so on. So I'm afraid that unification is sort of becoming less of a concern for South Korea with the new generation coming up.
Sumi Terry, thank you very much for joining us today. Sumi Terry is a senior research scholar in the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University, joining us this hour to talk about North Korea. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this program, Cynthia Schuster for on-air direction, Amanda Magnus handling the phones. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network.